coming out of the woodwork now, from all the virtual launches that we had during the lockdowns, we're actually getting out there and actually driving cars for real now.
We are indeed. And you and I and Brenwyn, we were both on the new Porsche 911 Turbo S launch. You guys were down in Cape Town last week. I was driving it earlier this week. And at the same time, they launched the new Cayenne GTS, which was also pretty impressive. But coming out of a 911 Turbo S, even that seems a little bit slow. I don't know what you guys think.
Well, that 911 Turbo S is certainly quite brisk. It's not often that you accelerate a car using launch control and you can actually feel the blood draining out of your head. But that's what I experienced in the Turbo S, which zooms from rest to 100 in the claimed 2.7 seconds. And by the way that those G-forces felt, I had no trouble believing that claim. I don't know whether you tried the launch control as well, Thomas, but I know Brenwyn did, and he seemed just as excited about it as I was.
I sure did, and I remember at our lunch stop complaining to Dennis that I had a slight headache because that launch control was just that brutal.
It totally is. I mean, I tried it many times. We had a fantastic test route, a lot of long, straight, empty roads where we could pull over and, indulge ourselves. That car just accelerates like nothing else out there. The way it puts its power down onto the tarmac is just incredible. But to me, what was even more impressive was the way this car handled. 911 turbos, as we know, aren't always the sharpest of driving tools in the 911 range that normally goes to the GT cars. But Porsche has done a great deal to finesse the handling and dynamic qualities of the Turbo S. And we got to drive it up Front Shock Pass, and it was really good. It's engaging, tons of grip, lots of feedback. It's a phenomenal, phenomenal car. And I think the older I get, the more I want a little bit of comfort, a little bit more sound deadening, softer, more supported seats. And that's what the Turbo offers, It's an everyday, livable, drivable car. Insanely fast when you feel like indulging yourself. But from a day-to-day point of view, it feels no harsher than a Golf GTI. I mean, I think they've done a phenomenal job.
That's always been the magic of the 911 in the way that it combines those two discordant disciplines. And I also found it, we drove it for several hundred kilometers, and it was a comfortable drive and a normal commuting car. But when you press the Sport or the Sport Plus mode, then it just explodes into angry action. And I also drove it through Front Shock Pass, and it's really so pinned down. It's such a sweet handling vehicle. I mean, I think it really could be the world's most perfect sort of day-to-day supercar.
Absolutely agree with you. And also, I mean, when you factor in how much it costs, it's just over 3.8 million rand. When you look at how much comparable performance cars cost, I mean, I don't know what a McLaren 720S is going for these days. It's probably up in the 7 million rand range. A 911 Turbo S starts to look like pretty darn good value, considering how much you get for your money.
It's difficult to tell most people that 3.8 million is good value. But yeah, as you say, in this context, compared to what else you can get, it certainly is good value.
Yeah. Well, look, to all you listeners out there, you can read Brenwyn's impressions and Dennis's impressions and my impressions in the next coming days. Brenwyn will be in the Sowetan and on Times Live Motoring. And Dennis, your impressions are obviously going up on Thursday on BD Motor News, correct?
Okay, Business Day Motor News, that's right, yes.
Yeah, brilliant. Well, lots to read there. Dennis, are you flying back down to Cape Town again for a launch of a two-wheeled, I won't say a superbike, but it's a pretty cool bike.
I am indeed. So BMW is taking on Harley-Davidson with its R18 Cruiser. And I've seen it in the metal. And it's a monster of a machine. It looks like something that could be used as a ship's anchor. So we'll see what it rides like. Now, I'm not necessarily the world's biggest cruiser bike fan. I prefer something that turns a bit better and is maybe a little bit more nimble. But we'll see. This is all about laid-back cruising, lifestyle kind of biking, and we'll see if it fits the bill.
Yeah, interested to hear what you think. I mean, I've seen them in action. It is a monstrously big bike. You need a lot of space to turn them around. But I think BMW's done a fantastic job on it. And they just seem to be building bikes that appeal to such a broad spectrum of consumers. I mean, they've got their radically fast sports bikes. They've got their cruisers. They've got off-roaders, tourers. They really seem to be at the top of their game at the moment.
Yeah, they certainly have a vast range and they're filling every niche.
Yeah, yeah. Well, cool. I mean, I look forward to reading your impressions about that. Going to move on over to Brenwyn. Brenwyn, what's been happening in your world? Have you been driving anything interesting?
Yeah, I have. Well, I mean, in addition to that 911 turbo, I've been putting a whole lot of mileage on that Polo GTI long-term that I often like to talk about. Recently went from Joburg to Cape Town to PE and back to Joburg, a nice loop, just a leisurely loop, you know, over a weekend.
As one does, yeah.
You know, as one does, just get a bit of fresh Cape air and stuff, and that was good. But on my radar this week, I saw something really interesting, and that's about the revival of the brand Hummer. And I'm sure you gentlemen remember Hummer, that brand birthed from military roots with boxy, bullish vehicles that were adapted to civilian applications and popularized thanks to cameos in various hip-hop music videos and films. Now, I mean, we knew that the revival of the nameplate was imminent, and now it's official. GM has resuscitated it, and this time it's electric. And also, Hummer is no longer a standalone brand, but it will be offered under the GMC banner. So aesthetically, it stays true to the templates of its forebears, still designed using only a ruler, and with enough presence to frighten even the most obstinate Polo driver out of the far-right lane. Its electric heart delivers 746 kilowatts and a whopping 11,500 foot-pounds of torque, which translates into 15,591 newton meters. It's not a typographical error. It's ridiculous, actually.
It's insane.
And then GM claims a driving range of 560 kilometers on a full charge. So, can we expect it in SA? I wouldn't hold my breath. I mean, we all know that GM disinvested from the country rather abruptly in 2017, and so a return would seem unlikely. Still, it does look really cool.
It does, and I'm sure one or two might end up in South Africa. You know, we've all got these diehard Hummer fans and people, you know, with a bit of cash, like to stand out with quirky cars, so, you know, maybe we might see one cruising the streets of Cape Town or Joburg. Sticking with Americana, Dennis, you've got the inside story on a very, very fast, bespoke American Sportster.
Yes, it seems to be quite a week for sports cars. An SSC Tuatara, which most of our listeners have probably never heard of, but this has become the world's fastest supercar. British racing driver Oliver Webb set a new production vehicle land speed record of 508.73 kilometers an hour in this car. And this was an average of two directions. So on the one run, he actually managed even faster than that. He went almost 533 k's an hour. It was only because of heavy crosswinds that they weren't able to go that same speed in the other direction. But anyway, that Koenigsegg Agera RS, the Swedish supercar that most people also haven't heard of, probably, said 47 kilometers an hour. And just while we're talking about these amazing high-speed feats, a Bugatti Chiron, which more people probably have heard of, achieved 490 on a German test track last year. But it was a single-direction run, so it didn't count as an official record. But anyway, it's quite amazing to see what road cars are able to do that nowadays. Over 508 kilometers an hour for a road car that you can actually buy.
It's absolutely insane. I mean, if you had enough fuel and no speed limits, you'd probably get down to Cape Town in just over 2 hours, which is absolutely phenomenal. Do you have any ideas how much it's retailing for? I know they're only building about 100 of these cars.
That's right, yeah. About 99 of them, I believe. But no, I don't have a retail price. I'll have to look into that. But, yeah, it's probably a bit more than that Porsche 911 Turbo S we spoke about earlier.
Yeah, it certainly is. I mean, I saw reports of it, you know, sort of going for 28 million rand. I don't know if that's true or not. But it kind of sounds like the ballpark figure for something as special as that car is. What else is happening, guys? From my side, I see the Toyota Land Cruiser Prado has been updated. It's now got that new 2.8-liter turbo diesel engine that's in the new facelifted Hilux. So you've got a little bit more power, a little bit more torque, and a 6-speed box. The old car had a 5-speed box. So yeah, that's quite big news if you were considering getting a Prado. Now's the time to do it. And if you have a small business, Mahindra's now got a new panel van called it's a KUV hashtag Express, you know, and it's just a nice, affordable little panel van coming in at just under 180,000 Rand, a rival to that Kia Picanto Runner that came out earlier this year. So if you need a stoic, economical little panel van, that's probably worth a look in.
That 180,000 Rand price tag is quite attractive, I think, to small business owners and florists and such like. So, you know, that seems to be a bit of a trend after that Kia that you've just mentioned as well. So we no longer have half-ton Buckies, except for the Nissan NP200. Things like we obviously lost that Chevrolet or Opel Corsa Bucky. So that's why these little... The panel vans that are based on hatchbacks are coming out of the woodwork now, so it's an interesting trend.
Yeah, and I mean, they actually make quite a bit of sense, you know, because obviously the side windows and the rear windows are blocked out. So from a security point of view, you know, it's just safer to transport your cargo in something like that. And yeah, I mean, it is really good value because that Kia Picanto Runner is now just over 200,000 Rand. It's gone up since it first launched, so... Yeah, I think Mahindra should do pretty well with that car. I think that's it, guys. Brenwyn, anything else before we sign off?
Not really, Tom, other than to say that I'll be driving some new cars in the coming weeks. I'll be driving the new Hyundai Grand i10 on Thursday, which I'm really looking forward to. I've always fancied that car in that category, and I think the styling revisions that they've endowed on this updated version should go down well.
Yeah, for sure. Cool, guys. Well, Dennis, enjoy your motorbike launch.
Thank you, Thomas.
That you're escaping this terrible heat for the cooler Cape Town climate. And, just be safe out there.
Thanks a lot, Tom.
Like it, guys. Cool. We're going to take a quick break. And when we return, we're going to be joined in studio by a special guest. So stay tuned for that.
Join me, Nicole Engelbrecht, your host on True Crime South Africa, a weekly podcast that covers both solved and unsolved South African true crime cases.
Welcome back to Cargumentative. In this segment of the show, we're joined in the virtual studio by Robert Walker, who is the director and owner of the Sasol Solar Challenge, a unique and sustainable motorsport event that's been soaking up the sun since 2008. Robert, thanks so much for finding the time to join us.
Oh, it's an absolute pleasure, and thank you very much for having me.
It's always cool to have interesting guests on the show. So, yeah, it's... a real treat to have you here today. But before we go any further, Robert, I just wanted to know if you could perhaps tell our listeners a little bit more about who you are and what your role is at the SSC.
So my name is Rob Walker. I run a events specialist company. We kind of specialize in, dare I say, pretty off the wall events. So not your typical stuff. We tend to try and work really exclusively on things that we feel a bit more strategic and probably a bit more that move the needle, so to speak. So not just your average events, although they're great and they have their place. We really try and differentiate ourselves by doing stuff that's different. My role in the Sasol Solar Challenge is I'm the event director. So I try and oversee all the various portfolios of the event, from competitors to regulations to education, and obviously a big part of my role is also working with our sponsors and partners across the country. So I spend a lot of time trying to align with various sponsors and government bodies and NGOs and interest groups. So I spend a lot of time talking the talk when it comes to Sassasota Challenge.
Okay, well, that's good to know. And then, you know, for our listeners who might not be familiar with the Solar Car Challenge, can you give a quick rundown about what this event entails?
Yes, so the event was founded in 2008 by a gentleman called Winston Yordan, and he ran it for a number of years. We took over it at the end of the conclusion of the 2016 event, and ran the 2018 event, and obviously we're supposed to have run the 2020 event, but you know then COVID happened. But basically the Sassasota Challenge in its traditional form is a 8-day challenge. For teams, mostly university teams, but also high school teams as well as privateers, to drive a vehicle powered exclusively by the sun from Pretoria down to Cape Town. And if that weren't enough, what we also throw at the teams is the opportunity for them to rack up more kilometers on each day at our kind of pit stops, or our control stops as we call them. And what we give the teams there is a loop on the route of that day where they can then try and rack up many more kilometers. So to give you an example, last year, the last running of the event in 2018, the Dutch team, which was then known as Nuon, now are called Vattenfall, from the University of Delft, they accumulated over 4,200 kilometers between Pretoria and Cape Town, using only the power of the sun to power them through the course and down to Cape Town. The cars are basically exclusively designed for this, and they really are tip of the spear vehicles. You know, most of them weigh less than about 200 kilograms. They have extremely low rolling resistance, and they are engineering marvels. Most of them use space age materials and technology, and they really do push the envelope as far as finding the ultimate when it comes to efficiency. And efficiency in our game is balancing the energy that you can generate from the sun versus the energy required to drive, as well as also store in your batteries. At their core, solar cars are actually EVs, so they have a electric drivetrain. But unlike traditional EVs and Teslas and Jaguar I-Paces that the people would know, which get their energy from a wall socket or a charge point, these cars actually generate that energy from the sun. So in essence, it is a distance-first race. So the person who clocks the most kilometers from Pretoria to Cape Town over 8 days wins at its most basic form.
Okay. Now, this might be a silly question that you get to ask quite often. What happens if it's a cloudy day or if it's a rainy day? Do you guys just, you know, sort of throw in the towel and have a rest day, or are these cars able to actually propel themselves a little bit without the sun on power that they've managed to store in their battery packs, if they have battery packs?
So it actually is a great question, and we do get it all the time, because people hear solar and they believe, you know, the car must run only in hot weather and bright sunshine. Part of the South African challenge with the Sassasola Challenge is, unlike the other events around the world, for example, the Bridgestone World Solar Challenge in Australia, weather is a big part of our event. So yes, the teams have batteries, and again, this is the efficiency debate that the teams have to go through. If you have lots of batteries, it's great, but you also add lots of weight. And if you have lots of weight, then you require more energy to move that weight. So teams are always looking for this optimal balance between how much battery is enough battery, or how much creates too much weight for them. So they, that's the first decision they take. What a lot of the teams will actually end up having with the event, especially in South Africa, is they will have a forward chase vehicle, which will be a day ahead of the race as we come down, or the challenge, I should say. And that will actually be a weather vehicle. vehicle, and they'll be monitoring the weather conditions coming in. Many of them subscribe to a lot of data that they analyze, mountains of data on the move. They have teams of data analysts, and they will actually be trying to understand and anticipate what the next day's weather is going to be. So for example, in 2018, when we rode from into Sedgefield, we went through Corriedo, and we basically, as we arrived through Sedgefield, the clouds came in, and the clouds came over, and we woke up the next morning to a quite literal torrential downpour. And the teams drove the whole way from Sedgefield to Swellendam. They did loop stops, they did everything. So what the teams really are doing is analyzing all the external factors the day before, and then they're deciding, okay, how fast they're going to drive, because if they drive a little bit slower in a sunny day, then it gives them the opportunity to recharge and replenish their battery in anticipating that the next day is going to be a day where they won't get that much charge. So they try and avoid the situation where they get their battery down to low percentages, 10-15%, because if they get down to that point, then they actually need to pull over on the side of the road and they will charge. And listeners who have seen the solar challenge coming through their towns, they would see some teams, they get that calculation wrong, and then they do have to pull over to the side of the road, they lift their array up, and they have to charge for half an hour, 45 minutes in order to get their battery to a stable level. The top teams in the world really talk about the challenge, both ours and the Australian one, but it really comes down to battery management. You start the event at the start line with 100% charged battery, and you go down through the first day. And let's say the first day is a bright sunny day, you use 30% of your battery to get to the first overnight stop, but you only manage to recharge 25%. So in layman's terms, you now start the next morning with a battery that's 95%, because obviously they can't charge the batteries overnight. We seal the batteries every night, so they can't charge them. So it's really important that you manage your battery as you go down through the days, because once you start getting closer to Cape Town, the teams will start running their batteries lower and lower. Obviously, a team doesn't want to cross the finish line in Cape Town with a battery that's still at 60-70%. Because that means that they could have been going faster, which would have maybe given them more kilometers, and that would be a higher result for them. On the flip side, you also don't want to be pulling over on the very last day when teams are chasing hard and having to charge or not be able to do a final loop stop. To give you an idea, in 2018, our top teams were only separated, I think it was by, I think at the end of the day, it was 42 kilometers. Now, that both of them have done over 4,000 Ks. So you're talking about a 1% error of margin, or margin of error, I should say, between the top teams. So it's really, really important that the teams manage that battery pack.
It actually sounds quite scientific, and one has this idea that it's just a driver in a solar car driving along the highway. But I guess most of the race is won or lost by quite a big support team, and I'm sure that there are people there with computers and suns and maths and all kinds of things like that who will then communicate to the driver and say, here we need you to speed up, here you must slow down. Is that correct? I mean, is yeah. Is it quite a support team heavy event?
So it's actually this is really an interesting side of us. It's probably the one form of, and we don't refer to solar car challenging as motorsport, but a lot of viewers will understand motorsport. But it's probably the one form where the driver is, and with respect to the drivers of solar cars, yes, driving a solar car is not easy, especially in crosswinds. It's not an easy thing to do. But most of the time, they are the most important cog of the wheel. The engineering that goes into these cars and the science behind what these guys do. To give you an example, in Australia last year when I was there, I witnessed a team that calculated the exact speed that they had to drive so that when they got to, there was a stop and go for, in the middle of the outback, funny enough, there was a stop and go for them fixing a cattle grid. And the team had a forward control car that worked out the exact speed that they had to drive so that when they reached this point, they wouldn't have to stop and that the light would go green and their car and their team could go through unabated and wouldn't have to slow down. Because obviously slowing down unnecessarily is the kind of the worst thing that you can do with a car that's seeking efficiency. You want to try and keep that car maintaining an exact speed without any bumps. So the teams are incredibly full of engineers and scientists, and they calculate every nth degree. We've had teams that came out in 2018 that drove the route twice before we actually got down, and they were calculating angles of turn, they were calculating inclines and declines, and they calculate all these aspects to ensure that when the driver's in the car, they can say to him, okay, for the next 10 kilometers, the optimal speed to drive is 66.5 kilometers an hour, or going down the downhill, please let off, this is a long downhill, we need to maintain. And they work out every aspect to maintain efficiency. So the teams arrive normally in South Africa, some of the South African teams, with up to 50 people in the team. And these are analysts, these are weather specialists, they have teams of battery specialists, they have electrical engineers, they're full of everything that you could possibly imagine to support the drivers and obviously support the car. And what they do is they analyze every scenario. We've had teams before where they've even analyzed the impact on what would happen if they got a flat tire and how that would affect them and how fast they could change that flat tire in different stages of the race and what that would mean for them. So for these guys, it's really about pushing the envelope as far as you can. And these cars are like most motoring cars, they're designed on a knife edge. So easily something can not go wrong, but so easily a bump or a hard crosswind or something can offset the cars. And the teams are planning for that to make sure that as much as possible that they run a perfect race. And I think most teams out there who hear this would agree with me is that there's no such thing as the perfect race, but every single team tries to cross the finish line to say they race their race or their challenge to 90% of what their plan was. And either they come first or they come, you know, stone last. As long as they competed to 90% of what they wanted to compete, most teams would be happy for that. It's just the amount of data that these students and these participants consume and go through is utterly phenomenal. And any aspect that you can think of around an open road challenge that would affect any performance issue. If you think what I was talking about earlier about the winners of the event were separated by a 1% error of margin. So if you can find that your analysis of the wind, for example, coming down the passes into Graaffreinet, if you can time it so that your car receives a tailwind instead of a headwind, you can quite easily gain that 1% over your competitor. And that's how fine and how detailed these guys go down to.
That's incredible. I mean, it sounds like they could give some Formula One teams a run for their money, you know?
I saw things in Australia, which is the world where the best teams come, and they've got analysts on analysts, and it looks like Formula One teams. It is utterly phenomenal. And these are all students. These are guys who are, you know, in the ages of between 20 and 30. Many of them are actually now, I know of two people who actually are part of Formula One teams who are chief strategists, because strategy that's everything that plays its part.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I mean, segueing from Formula One, that's a sport that's going to see a lot of big changes in 2022, where many parts are going to be standardized, and all teams will have access to them. In the solar car challenge, are there certain parts that are standardized? Like, do all teams have to have a same size battery pack in terms of kilowatt hours? What parts are mandated by you guys and what parts are open for interpretation?
So what we try and do is we have a set of technical regulations where we do try and we try and allow the engineering creativity to come through. And the reason is that because at its core we are an engineering and science challenge. So to standardize too much would actually defeat the purpose of the event, which is for people to push the envelope. However, what we do is in 2016 Bridgestone World Solar Challenge shrunk the solar array size from 6 square meters down to 4 square meters, and that was because the arrays themselves were becoming so efficient that the cars were actually becoming far too fast. So the amount of energy being collected was too much. So we shrunk the arrays down. I know, for example, for the Bridgestone World Solar Challenge, and we work with them so that we have a similar set of regulations. So the teams competing in both events don't have to design completely new cars. When they released their regulations 2-3 months ago, there's basically two main types of solar arrays that the guys use. There's a silicon-based cell and there's a gallium arsenide-based cell. And the gallium arsenide is incredibly more expensive. So the top teams with lots of sponsors go with gallium arsenide because it's a higher efficiency model. But the silicon cells are a lot more cost effective and it creates a bit of an uneven playing field. So for the next Bridgestone World Solar Challenge next year in October, you actually may not use gallium arsenide cells. So they put a technical restriction in to try and force the innovation to make the cars a little bit more affordable, but also a lot more real world scenario, because ultimately what we're trying to do is develop technology such as the in-wheel motor, which was actually developed on a solar car many years ago, which now you see in the EVs out on the world, that makes it into commercialization. So using something that's prohibitively expensive doesn't push the envelope. So what happens is every 2 to 4 years the big events get together and we discuss how we can put limits on the teams, not necessarily in terms of batteries or kilowatt hours, because the efficiency battle will do that. Because if the teams want a massive battery with a lot of kilowatt hours, they're gonna lose on the weight side. So the natural way of how the challenges run will lead them to find the most efficient solution for their car. But what we try and do is bring it back a bit when the technology starts to push too forward. Another change was in 2018 when I was in Australia, or 2019 I should say, we were talking about how the solar car drivers are all the smallest guys on the team. So normal, you know, I'm a normal South African guy, I'm 6 foot, I couldn't envisage getting into a solar car because I'm too big. So now what's happened is the occupant cell of the solar car has been required to be a certain size to fit a certain type of individual. And again, that's then challenged the teams to say, right, teams, you know, you need to make sure that a normal person can get in this car, so to speak. So what we try and do is instead of limiting the engineering side, because that's where we want the teams, we want them to push the envelope, we want them to come with the next evolution of what mobility is going to look like in 10 to 15 years time, and that mobility is going to come from events like the SASA Solar Challenge. What we rather want to do is we try and limit them where there becomes too much of a gap between the teams that have a huge amount of funding and have massive sponsors and the teams that don't, and we try and make sure that we keep that gap as tight as possible through limiting them. It just makes it more fair, because at its heart, we're an engineering challenge. So if we gave a set of regulations which prevented the teams from pushing the envelope, then there wouldn't really be much point in it, so to speak.
No, absolutely. We've touched on efficiency very briefly. I mean, how fast can these cars actually travel?
So without naming and shaming any teams out there, we've clocked a team before, and I won't say where because they received a penalty for us, but they were doing in excess of 100, they were doing about 140 Ks an hour.
Really? Wow. Okay. So, that's quick.
So they are quick. They are obviously designed in wind tunnels. I mean, I remember we overtook a car in Australia from one of the smaller teams. So the team that won the Bridgestone World Solar Challenge last year from Darwin to Adelaide, they averaged just under 90 kilometers an hour over 4 days. So you can imagine if that's the average speed, and that includes stops, that includes pit stops, you know, it includes everything. That was their average speed in terms of their race time and what they got there. That means that car is traveling on average about 100 k's an hour all the time, every time. So it's real world speeds that these guys are doing. This is always something I'm fascinated about. Whenever we bring solar cars out, people see them and they see how they're small and they're streamlined and they're at the extreme, and people think, oh, okay, you know, these cars will only do 30, 40 k's an hour, and then we let them go. And yes, they don't necessarily accelerate, you know, like a race car, definitely not. But once they get up to the optimal speed that team has determined, they will hold that speed quite happily over insane distances, you know, hundreds of kilometers.
Amazing, huh? Absolutely amazing. I didn't know that they were that rapid. Now, I mean, would you say that the learnings from the solar car challenge are starting to trickle through to the man in the street? I mean, is there a technology transfer coming out of the event that manufacturers can start to use in their cars, or, you know?
I think the rate of adoption of the technology is probably faster than maybe the guys who are traditional motorsport guys will hate me for saying this, but I think we probably are significantly faster than traditional motorsports. And the reason I say that is it's obviously all the manufacturers now are chasing future mobility and cleaner transport and all those good things. But there's a car out there at the moment being developed in the Netherlands called Lightyear One. And Lightyear One is actually founded by previous solar challenge participants, and it runs purely off solar power, and it's a workable car. It works, but in the previous years we've seen, especially when it comes to battery technology and motor technology, because the teams are constantly on the hunt for smaller, more efficient motors and ultimately lighter as well. What they do is, you know, they develop this technology which they push to the cutting edge, and very quickly it is getting adapted by manufacturers. So I believe personally that batteries that we see in the future, which have longer ranges, which are more efficient, and allow people to drive further, those batteries are being developed right now by people who competed in various solar challenges around the world. Elon Musk very famously tweeted, I think it was 2 years ago, he looks first to hire engineers out of the Stanford solar car team, because they're at the cutting edge. And that means that those guys, the tech that they're developing, it finds its way very quickly, because if you're looking for an EV car to be able to go far, ultimately it needs to be as light as possible, with a battery that's as efficient as possible, that also charges as quickly as possible from whatever energy source. Those three aspects are what makes also the most successful solar car. If the car can charge off a small light solar array, it can retain that charge within its battery to a high degree. The battery doesn't have to be heavy and weigh a lot. Then it means that what they've achieved is efficiency. And ultimately, I believe that's why we see the technology trickling down very quickly, because the team's goal and most manufacturers' goal now is similar. It's efficiency. That's what they're looking for.
And now, I mean, if I wanted to enter this, is it open to anybody, or is it open to universities only? Or, I mean, is there a strict criteria, or basically if you feel like making your own solar car and you've got the money, you know, are you able to enter?
Yeah. So what we do is 99% of our entries are from universities, just because of the requirements in terms of the capacity, the departments you require, the engineering that's going in. But that being said, is we don't look away from privateers. We have had privateers enter in the past who have put their own cars forward and funded a team, so to speak. We are really encouraging and driving a lot more high school participation. We've had high school teams enter since 2016, and one of our strategic goals going forward is to grow this still, probably in a class that will be a little bit more accessible for the high schools to operate in, but really the goal is to try and get the guys when they're 15, 16 into solo car racing and into engineering. So we plot almost a 10-year path for them, so by the time they finished their degrees at university at 26, they've been with us for about 10 years. So it is open to anyone. We do have a quite exhaustive set of technical regulations. So it's important that you have, people, if you want to put together a private team who understand, electrical engineering and all the bits and bobs that go along with it. It is open for anyone, but we normally suggest that, if somebody's within a faculty or they're passionate to want to get involved, 9 times out of 10, we direct them towards a university or their local university to become involved in a project or to lead a project with the support of the universities. It's a more successful, sustainable way of being involved.
Sure. I mean, that high school program scheme sounds fantastic. I think if I'd had that back in high school, I probably wouldn't have dropped science after standard 7. So yeah, I think that's a really clever idea that you guys
and I think you've summed it up, man. I like, to be honest with you, for us, we need to, especially in South Africa, we need to get as much of our youth not dropping science and maths and the subjects that they need to. And this is one way that we've seen it, and I say it a lot of times when people ask me what for me sum up the SASL Solar Challenge, and I say it's very simple. When I'm going through some of the most rural parts of South Africa where towns that most South Africans won't even know, if I said to you, please point this town out on a map, you wouldn't even know where it is. And we engage with the youth, and they see the opportunity that engineering and science can afford them, and that they don't have to walk a certain path in life, which would potentially be a path of being in the rural areas. That this is technology that can take you to the moon. It is changing lives on an ongoing basis, and we see it every time we go down the road. And with the support of SASL, we help change the perspective of the young guys out there to see that actually engineering and mobility and science is something that is exciting and it is cool, and you should stick with it.
Yeah, totally is. We're running out of time, unfortunately, yeah. Rob, but this year's event was canned, obviously, to a certain pandemic. But it's been rescheduled for 2021. What dates is it going to be happening, and what can people look forward to? Is there anything special on the cards for next year?
So the event was postponed till February 2021, obviously due to COVID. We need to make sure that everyone's safe and happy and looking good. The event in February is going to be a track-based event held at Red Star Raceway out in Delmas. They graciously allowed us to take over the whole event, the whole venue, I should say. And we're going to be running from the weekend of the 20th, 21st of February up until the Friday the 26th. We'll hopefully, fingers crossed, be open to public, government regulations permitting at that time, and we still have been really pleased with a collection of both international and local teams who will be attending, and the teams will still have to compete for a distance first event, which will be determined on the racetrack. They'll have to cover a certain set distance every day, with every kilometre thereafter credited towards them. So we're still going to be following the traditional format. However, what we are going to be doing is broadcasting the event on various live stream platforms for the whole event. So anyone, no matter where they are in South Africa, they can tune in. If they're used to us coming through their town, they'll be able to tune in. They'll be able to see, meet the teams, interact with them. Essentially, what we've decided to do, and again, we wouldn't be able to do this without SASL's support, is we're going to create a physio virtual event. So we're physically going to be at Red Star Racing in a pretty much bubble, like you see for Formula One, keeping everyone safe and COVID free. But we're going to interact and engage with our audience and the schools, our schools program. Everything else is going completely virtual. And we're going to be reaching out to tens of thousands of viewers every day from around the world who will be able to follow the event in a completely virtual environment. And through this way, we're managing to keep both our spectators and our teams, you know, hopefully safe and also being abiding by the regulations the government has set out.
Very, very cool. I mean, yeah, streaming is the future, as we all know, with Netflix and Hulu and all these other, you know, fantastic online media platforms. So, yeah, I'm sure you guys will reach a much broader audience, not just in South Africa, but also internationally. Red Star is very cool.
Yeah.
I know it quite well. So
great group of guys there as well.
It is, yeah. So hopefully I can sneak in and see you guys in action, because I'd love to see these cars, actually. They sound really, you know, exciting, cutting edge, next level science. So, yeah. Hopefully I can come along to that.
We would love to have you, man, and please, it would be great to have you and show you what the future of mobility looks like.
Yeah, no, fantastic. I'd love to see. If people want to find out more about the Sasol Solar Challenge, where can they go? Do you guys have a website? Do you guys have an Instagram account?
So we have a website which is just actually being updated as we speak. It should be live in the next day or two. It's solarchallenge.org.za. On there is everything. Everything you could possibly want is on there. So if you're intrigued and you'd like to look at maybe entering a team into our 2022 event, where we'll go back down the road, the technical regulations are there. You can have a look at everything. They can find us Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. You just have to search SA Solar Challenge, and we'll come up. We're all over there. We post content on a daily basis, all sorts of things, from engineering content to team content to the community of solar car racing. So if people want to engage with us there, we're very, very active all over the digital platforms. And as we ramp up towards February's event, so that activity will only increase. And we would welcome, you know, anyone to engage with us there and chat to us, ask us questions. If you're a student and you're looking to get your university involved, drop us a line. We're there to help you guys and try and get as many South African teams involved as possible. And also hopefully get them over to Australia to go and compete on the international stage and wave the South African flag high.
Fantastic. Robert, listen, we are out of time, unfortunately, but again, thanks for taking the time out to join us in the virtual studio. It was really cool to hear all about the Sasol Solar Car Challenge and the ins and outs, and something to look forward to next year.
Yeah, no, thanks very much for having me. It's been an absolute pleasure, and I hope we get to chat again soon.
Me too. That was Robert Walker, the director of the Sasol Solar Challenge. And folks, that's it for this episode. We're out of time. We hope you enjoyed it, and we hope you'll join us again for another episode of Cargumentative.